do you find so damn funny?" he snapped angrily. "You know it. I don't know what's the matter with you. I don't know what's happened to you in the last 2 months, ever since you came back. You've never been so uncooperative." "Why, Jim, I haven't argued with you in the last 2 months." "That's what I mean." He caught himself hastily, but not fast enough to miss her smile. "I mean, I wanted to have a conference. I wanted to know your view of the situation."
"You know it."
"But you haven't said a word."
"I said everything I had to say 3 years ago. I told you where your course would take you. It has."
"Now there you go again. What's the use of theorizing? We're here. We're not back 3 years ago. We've got to deal with the present, not the past. Maybe things would have been different if we had followed your opinion. Maybe. But the fact is that we didn't. And we've got to deal with facts. We've got to take reality as it is now, today."
"Well, take it."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Take your reality. I'll merely take your orders."
"That's unfair. I'm asking for your opinion."
"You're asking for reassurances, Jim. You're not going to get it."
"I beg your pardon?"
"I'm not going to help you pretend, by arguing with you, that the reality you're talking about is not what it is, that there's still a way to make it work and to save your neck. There isn't."
"Well..."
There was no explosion, no anger, only the feebly uncertain voice of a man on the verge of abdication.
"Well, what would you want me to do?"
"Give up." He looked at her blankly. "Give up. All of you. You and your Washington friends and your looting planners and the whole of your cannibal philosophy. Give up and get out of the way and let those of us who can start from scratch out of the ruins."
"No!"
The explosion came, oddly, now. It was the scream of a man who would die rather than betray his idea, and it came from a man who had spent his life evading the existence of ideas, acting with the expediency of a criminal. She wondered whether she had ever understood the essence of criminals. She wondered about the nature of the loyalty to the idea of denying ideas.
"No,"
he cried, his voice lower, hoarser, and more normal, sinking from the tone of a zealot to the tone of an overbearing executive.
"That's impossible. That's out of the question."
"Who said so?"
"Never mind, it's so. Why do you always think of the impractical? Why don't you accept reality as it is and do something about it? You're the realist, you're the doer, the mover, the producer, the Nat Taggart. You're the person who's able to achieve any goal she chooses. You could save us now. You could find a way to make things work. If you wanted to."
She burst out laughing. There, she thought, was the ultimate goal of all that loose academic prattle which businessmen had ignored for years. The goal of all the slipshod definitions, the sloppy generalities, the soupy abstractions, all claiming that obedience to objective reality is the same as obedience to the state, that there is no difference between a law of nature and a bureaucrat's directive, that a hungry man is not free, that man must be released from the tyranny of food, shelter, and clothing. All of it for years, that the day might come when Nat Taggart, the realist, would be asked to consider the will of Cuffy Meggs as a fact of nature, irrevocable and absolute like steel, rails, and gravitation, to accept the Meggs-made world as an objective, unchangeable reality, then to continue producing abundance in that world. There was the goal of all those con men of library and classroom who sold their revelations as reason, their instincts as science, their cravings as knowledge. The goal of all the savages of the non-objective, the non-absolute, the relative, the tentative, the probable. The savages who, seeing a farmer gather a harvest, can consider it only as a mystic phenomenon, unbound by the law of causality, and created by the farmer's omnipotent whim, who then proceed to seize the farmer, to chain him, to deprive him of tools, of seeds, of water, of soil, to push him out on a barren rock, and to command, "Now grow a harvest and feed us." No, she thought, expecting Jim to ask it. It would be useless to try to explain what she was laughing at. He would not be able to understand it. But he did not ask it. Instead, she saw him slumping and heard him say, terrifyingly, because his words were so irrelevant if he did not understand, and so monstrous if he did, "Dagny, I'm your brother." She drew herself up, her muscles growing rigid, as if she were about to face a killer's gun. Dagny? His voice was the soft, nasal, monotonous whine of a beggar. I want to be president of a railroad. I want it. Why can't I have my wish as you always have yours? Why shouldn't I be given the fulfillment of my desires as you always fulfill any desire of your own? Why should you be happy while I suffer? Oh, yes, the world is yours. You're the one who has the brains to run it. Then why do you permit suffering in your world? You proclaim the pursuit of happiness, but you doom me to frustration. Don't I have the right to demand any form of happiness I choose? Isn't that a debt which you owe me? Am I not your brother? His glance was like a prowler's flashlight, searching her face for a shred of pity. It found nothing but a look of revulsion. It's your sin if I suffer. It's your moral failure. I'm your brother. Therefore, I'm your responsibility, but you failed to supply my wants. Therefore, you're guilty. All of mankind's moral leaders have said so for centuries. Who are you to say otherwise? You're so proud of yourself. You think that you're pure and good. But you can't be good so long as I'm wretched. My misery is the measure of your sin. My contentment is the measure of your virtue. I want this kind of world, today's world. It gives me my share of authority. It allows me to feel important. Make it work for me. Do something. How do I know what? It's your problem and your duty. You have the privilege of strength, but I have the right of weakness. That's a moral absolute. Don't you know it? Don't you? Don't you? His glance was now like the hands of a man hanging over an abyss, groping frantically for the slightest fissure of doubt, but slipping on the clean, polished rock of her face. You bastard, she said evenly, without emotion, since the words were not addressed to anything human. It seemed to her that she saw him fall into the abyss. Even though there was nothing to see in his face except the look of a con man whose trick has not worked. There was no reason to feel more revulsion than usual, she thought. He had merely uttered the things which were preached, heard, and accepted everywhere. But this creed was usually expounded in the third person, and Jim had had the open effrontery to expound it in the first. She wondered whether people accepted the doctrine of sacrifice, provided its recipients did not identify the nature of their own claims and actions. She turned to leave. No, no, wait, he cried, leaping to his feet with a glance at his wristwatch. It's time now. There's a particular news broadcast that I want you to hear. She stopped, held by curiosity. He pressed the switch of the radio, watching her face openly, intently, almost insolently. His eyes had a look of fear and of oddly lecherous anticipation. Ladies and gentlemen, the voice of the radio speaker leaped forth abruptly. It had a tone of panic. News of a shocking development has just reached us from Santiago, Chile. She saw the jerk of Taggart's head and a sudden anxiety in his bewildered frown, as if something about the words and voice were not what he had expected. A special session of the legislature of the People's State of Chile had been called for 10 o'clock this morning to pass an act of utmost importance to the people of Chile, Argentina, and other South American people states. In line with the enlightened policy of Señor Ramirez, the new head of the Chilean state, who came to power on the moral slogan that man is his brother's keeper, the legislature was to nationalize the Chilean properties of Danconia Copper, thus opening the way for the People's State of Argentina to nationalize the rest of the Danconia properties the world over. This, however, was known only to a very few of the top-level leaders of both nations. The measure had been kept secret in order to avoid debate and reactionary opposition. The seizure of the multi-billion-dollar Danconia Copper was to come as a munificent surprise to the country. On the stroke of 10, in the exact moment when the chairman's gavel struck the rostrum opening the session, almost as if the gavel's blow had set it off, the sound of a tremendous explosion rocked the hall, shattering the glass of its windows. It came from the harbor a few streets away, and when the legislators rushed to the windows, they saw a long column of flame where once there had risen the familiar silhouettes of the ore docks of Danconia Copper. The ore docks had been blown to bits. The chairman averted panic and called the session to order. The act of nationalization was read to the assembly to the sound of fire alarm sirens and distant cries. It was a gray morning, dark with rain clouds. The explosion had broken an electric transmitter, so that the assembly voted on the measure by the light of candles, while the red glow of the fire kept sweeping over the great vaulted ceiling above their heads. But more terrible a shock came later when the legislators called a hasty recess to announce to the nation the good news that the people now owned Donconia Copper. While they were voting, word had come from the closest and farthest points of the globe that there was no Donconia Copper left on Earth. Ladies and gentlemen, not anywhere. In that same instant, on the stroke of 10, by an infernal marvel of synchronization, every property of Donconia Copper on the face of the globe, from Chile to Siam to Spain to Pottsville, Montana, had been blown up and swept away.